Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, we're going to be having a chat about the history of the castle, the fortified buildings that were constructed throughout the Middle Ages. Very important part of history, of course. Why were they so important? Well, castles were a political, a military, an economic, and an administrative focal point throughout many civilizations, throughout particularly in Europe, much of European civilization throughout the Middle Ages. Their primary function, of course, was to house and defend rich nobles and their retinues. They were usually built in strategic locations in order to fortify or defend the area around them, often on raised ground, near popular travel routes, in places where they could project power into the surrounding region. And they had a huge influence on all sorts of stuff, from urban development to military tactics and strategy, all sorts of stuff, heavily influenced by castles. And they themselves were influenced as history continued. They changed in form and in function as well, as we'll get across. Today we're going to mainly focus on castles in historical Europe. That's where castles are most closely associated with. That's the area they're most closely associated with, of course. But as you'll discover, before the end of this episode, European castles, strongly influenced by military architecture from other parts of the world, particularly in the Middle East, from the early Middle Ages right through the early modern period, they changed, they evolved, they adapted new technologies, they became larger, grander, and more impressive. We're going to talk about all these changes, as well as why they were built in the first place, how they were built, how they were brought down, and ultimately the reason for their demise as militarily relevant buildings. As ever, a lot to get across today, so let's not waste any more time. Let's get underway with the history of the castles here. History of castles, here we go. We're going all the way back. Going all the way back here. Well, to essentially the beginning of recorded human history, because it turns out that when you have nice things and you don't want other people to come and take those nice things off you, coming up with a way to stop other people from even being able to get to those nice things in the first place is a good way to keep having the nice things that you don't want other people to get. Fortified structures are not a new idea. It's not as if, as the early Middle Ages began, people were like, oh, I should build walls around my gold. That's not how it went. Before we come to the classic idea of the medieval castle, let's talk about some of its precursors, because we go back a long way with this. There's evidence of large fortified buildings, huge fortified structures being built in truly ancient civilizations like the Indus River Valley, Egypt, throughout Mesopotamia, and of course, obviously, in China. Now, these weren't castles per se. We'll come to the distinction of between a fort and a castle directly. But, you know, if you've got a lot of food, a lot of wealth, and a lot of other stuff that you want to keep for yourself, putting big walls between you and the people who might, you know, try to take it from you is a great place to start. And then if you've got other people that you can perhaps give a little bit of that money to make sure the rest of the money stays in your pockets, they can stand near or on top of the buildings that you've built to keep your stuff safe and prevent other people from coming and getting it. So again, pretty rudimentary stuff here, pretty basic ideas. But it is interesting to see the way that the castle took a lot of these ideas to the next level, you know, and really developed and advanced a lot of these very core principles of, I guess, just basic possession, I suppose, really. But throughout the Bronze and Iron Ages, these fortified buildings, they started to crop up in very similar kind of areas throughout the entire, you know, throughout all of human civilization, on top of hills, hill forts. They were the most common form of fortification like this, as you might have guessed. These were forts that were, surprise, surprise, built on top of a hill. Very well-named piece of technology there. Hill forts were usually earthworks. That is to say that they were built by digging out ditches, and then the dirt that was used the dirt that was dug out of these ditches was used to build mounds that was next to these ditches, fortified with palisades, walls, all sorts of stuff like that. Now, these ditches and mounds, they usually surrounded the top of a hill. And there was usually more than one ring of ditches and mounds. Most hill forts would have several concentric rings of ditches, mounds, palisades, whatever else. And inside this fortified area, inside the ditches and the mounds of the palisade, there would be like a little settlement, you know, that could be easily defended, given not only the fortifications, but also the elevation of the hill fort sitting, you know, on top of a hill as it was. Very easy to defend. And very common, indeed, particularly common in Northern Europe. Plenty of accounts of the Romans encountering them as they went around, you know, conquering here, there and everywhere, both during the Republic and the Imperial phases of that civilization there. Despite being pretty primitive, hill forts were still very hard to attack, and even the might of ancient Rome had some trouble with some of them. They had to bring in, you know, siege weapons and siege engines in order to take down hill forts that were, again, quite easy to defend. For that matter, the Romans used to also build forts themselves. Most civilizations did. The Romans, they would build great big rectangular forts as their territory expanded. They'd secure their conquests, maintain control. A lot of these were simple earthwork structures with palisades, especially when an army was on the move. But others were more permanent. There were Roman evidence, you know, there's Roman forts that were built with stone, especially if it was in an area that they were looking to, you know, again, settle in more, sort of more permanently and have a bit of a tighter control over the surrounding population. But none of these structures that we've talked about so far, the forts or the hill forts, whatever else, none of these are castles. And there's a very simple reason why. People still debate even today about the exact definition of the word castle, but the most broadly accepted meaning of the word castle is a fortified structure, right, that was built to house a noble family, not just serve a military purpose. And this may seem like a largely academic distinction, but it's actually a very important one for the reasons that I said before. Castles took on a role that wasn't just military in the day-to-day affairs of the medieval period. Castles were an economic, a political, and an administrative center point of life in the Middle Ages. And for that reason, it's important to make that distinction between, you know, an ancient hill fort and a medieval castle. As we move from late antiquity into the Middle Ages, there are a few important changes that took place that led to the development of the castle as opposed to the fort in Europe. On a larger scale, there was a shift in the way that political power was focused. For instance, the collapse of the Carolingian Empire in the 9th century. These decentralized political power took a lot of power away from, you know, just one set of hands and spread it out amongst smaller lords and barons, made them more powerful. And in addition to things like this happening, this decentralization of power, the movement of people, whether it was for migration or invasion, prompted many landholders to want to bolster their defences in the face of potential aggressors. Islamic conquest, Viking raids, Magyar migration, all of these things combined with this less centralised political power structure meant that local rulers not only wanted to do more to protect themselves and their nice things from potential enemies, they also now had greater power and influence that enabled them to build, you know, castles and project this power over a greater area with more autonomy than they would have had under a centralized system, for example, like the Carolingian Empire. So what did these nobles do? They started to fortify the places that they lived, or indeed they moved to new places that were easier to defend and fortify, and they built their homes there. And this is where we begin to come across the early ancestors of the medieval castle. Local lords building houses of stone so they wouldn't burn up on high ground, often artificial high ground, surrounded by walls which would be made of earth, wood, or maybe in some cases even stone. This was rarer in earlier history, although it gets more common later on, as we'll talk about. These structures are referred to as Mott and Bailey castles, and they are widely accepted as when quote-unquote true castles began in the late 10th century. Mott here doesn't refer to a moat. We'll come to that. These words do have a similar etymology. A mott is not a body of water. It's an artificial hill flattened at the top, and it's on top of this flat hill where the bailey would be built. A bailey refers to the part of the castle that was the fortified part, the part within the curtain walls, whatever else. Inside the bailey, you'd find the keep, or the donjon, as it was called. The word keep is actually a more modern one. Back then, the main building inside a bailey, usually built very tall, very strong, it was called a donjon. And it's from that word that we get the modern word, you won't be surprised to learn, dungeon. the Lord and his family would live inside the donjon, while inside the curtain walls, depending on the size of the fortification, of course, you would find the Lord's retinue, his staff, knights, workers, servants, all sorts of stuff, as well as other buildings. Again, if size permitted, you'd see things like large Mott and Bailey castles could have barracks, stables, storage facilities, houses for the staff, sometimes even things like a chapel. Some got so big, in fact, that another wall would be built inside the bailey, leading to an inner bailey and an outer bailey. So you'd have a sort of you would come through the entrance into an area that would then again have another wall on the other side of it that would lead to another area, the inner bailey, where you'd find the donjon. With the outer bailey as a sort of buffer zone. And again, the baileys were often, the walls around the baileys were often built of wood. As time goes on, more of them would be built of stone. And the reason that stone was preferred, obviously, I probably don't have to tell you this, is because it didn't burn and it's much harder to break than wood. But the problem is stones are expensive. We'll talk about this when we talk about the actual construction of these buildings. But almost invariably, in most parts of Europe at least, the donjon would be built of stone. This was one of the main draws to building a Mott and Bailey castle. It was one of the main reasons that lords like this would build structures like these castles, is because the upgrade from a wooden house to a stone house was enormous. And, you know, even if you surrounded it with burnable palisade walls, it was still a very difficult thing to capture a well-defended donjon that was the centerpiece of a Mott and Bailey castle. And In an effort to shore up the defense of the structure as a whole, the gatehouse, the main entrance to every castle, was often also built of stone. The gatehouse was naturally the weakest point of the castle's defenses. It was a place where, you know, by definition, people could enter and exit. It was a place that by design was you know, supposed to facilitate that. So it was important that a gatehouse was much more defensible than any other part, because, again, as I say, it was the weakest part of any Mott and Bailey castle. So gatehouses, often built of stone, reflecting how important they were in the defense of the whole castle. And while they varied in size and shape, the typical gatehouse still had a number of common factors to it. Often it had two gates that were usually reinforced with a portcullis, that metal grid that could be lowered to prevent people from getting in and out, I guess, but mainly from getting in. And these two gates would be on either side of, at either end, I should say, of a covered corridor. This meant that if the gatehouse was breached, or if the first gate was breached, as the attackers would make their way to the second gate inside the gatehouse, right, these attackers would be concentrated into a confined space that they could be fired upon from above, from the defending forces that are in the upper story of the gatehouse. This is, essentially they're creating a choke point, a bottleneck that made it very difficult for attackers to get through into the other side, into the outer bailey, without suffering heavy losses from being, you know, bombarded from above inside the gatehouse. Now, you're probably at one point, I mean, we'll address this here, at one point you're going to probably say, oh, of course, that's where they poured the boiling oil on people. Now, this wasn't as common as you might think. It certainly happened, particularly in the Middle East, Northern Africa. It was much more common for boiling oil to be used in the defense of a castle. But it wasn't very common throughout Europe in particular. It didn't happen that much. A couple of reasons for this. Oil was quite expensive. And fires, think about this. If you're trying to defend a wooden palisade or any part of a fortification that's made of wood, heating up an enormous cauldron of oil on top of it is probably not a good idea. The risk of fire is very great. And even when these fortifications were made of stone, oil's still very expensive. Like, setting it on fire and throwing it on people that are trying to get into the castle is not a great sort of use of it. As I say, more common in the Middle East and North Africa, where it was a little more plentiful, a little less expensive. But all the same, the boiling oil and even to a lesser extent boiling water, from what my research indicated, was not as common as you might think. It certainly happened, certainly was part of the defense of a castle, but it wasn't sort of ubiquitous. It wasn't a defense that every single castle sought to make use of. Anyway, gatehouses, bottom line, key part of the defense of a castle as a way to bottleneck attackers and give defenders the maximum opportunity to attack them while they were seeking to gain entrance. And as an attacker, you had a very difficult task. Not only did you have to get through this gatehouse into the outer bailey, past another wall with potentially another gatehouse into the inner bailey, you then had to assault the donjon, which of course was made of stone. It was a tall order. And structures like this, even these Motte and Bailey castles very early on in the career of the castle, were notoriously difficult to attack as a result of all of these defensive measures. You're fighting uphill, up the Motte, this artificial hill. You can see even the ones that have survived today, these hills are largely conical and quite steep, difficult to climb at the best of times, never mind when you're getting attacked by arrow fire. And then you've got Gatehouse Bailey's, you know, donjons to get through. So very, very difficult indeed. They're widely considered to be the first proper castles because of their defensibility as a home of a noble lord, and their impact, as you can imagine, very significant. Castles like this, as they were built, they weren't just used for defense. They were used to project power, to rule over the surrounding area as a headquarters for military force and political force as well. Nobles would hold court in their castle, meaning that they were a center point of, not only military, but political administrative affairs. And in the 10th and the 11th centuries, a great many castles were built throughout Europe. In some areas, you needed the king's permission to do something like this, but in others, you didn't. And in some cases, even in areas where you did, local barons were actually autonomous and powerful enough to defy the king's rules and build castles of their own volition. So they started going up all over Europe once it was sort of discovered how useful they were as a military stronghold and a political center. They started going up, large ones, small ones, doesn't matter. There was a new way to concentrate and project power, and people jumped on it. But as we move further into the 11th century now, the number of castles spread throughout Europe increases enormously. There seemed to be a huge surge in castle building from the year 1000 and beyond. And in addition to the number of castles that were built, the way that they were built began to change significantly as well. Now, obviously, it's difficult to make sweeping generalizations and still remain accurate, but broadly speaking, more and more of these structures began to be built with stone rather than with wood. Now, a range of advantages that are pretty self-evident when it comes to building with stone. It's harder, it's tougher, it doesn't burn, it's going to be a lot stronger if you build a wall out of stone rather than out of wood. But there were also some significant drawbacks mainly within the construction process when it came to building with stone. We're going to talk about constructing castles a little later on, but I'll give you a little bit of a sneak preview here with what working with stone involved, right? Early castles built of wooden earth, right? Wood, earth, readily available. You could chop down forests, you can dig up dirt, very easy indeed. Stone, on the other hand, expensive. You had to quarry it, you had to transport it, you had to pay skilled masons to shape it, and it wasn't very easy to build with or anywhere near as plentiful as timber. As a result, stone castles didn't become more popular until the 11th century and beyond, and even then, not everywhere. In places like Iberia, where timber was less available, stone castles were much more common than in other locations. For example, throughout Scandinavia, wooden castles remained the most common type of castle in Scandinavia for a very, very long time. Some castles began to be built with moats. They're not as common as the popular conception of a castle would have you believe, but there were certainly plenty of castles that were built with moats. Often you'd be digging ditches around the castle anyway for earthwork fortifications and also to disrupt the deployment of siege weapons. Very difficult to roll a battering ram or a siege tower up to a curtain wall if there's a ditch in the way. So if you've got this ditch, you may as well fill it with water, right, to make it even more difficult and also to protect your castle from having tunnels dug underneath the walls themselves, right? A moat made that more or less impossible. You'd have to dig right under the moat, and even then it'd be very touch and go digging a tunnel underneath a moat. While we're on digging, by the way, many castles the walls didn't just stop didn't weren't just you know put on the ground. Many castles had fortifications dug deep into the earth, especially the ones that didn't have moats, in order to prevent people from tunneling underneath the walls. The foundations of the castle dug deep into the ground to make sure that you couldn't tunnel underneath them. So moats and deep fortifications, a good way to prevent your castle from being undermined in that way. But of course, if you had a moat, you had to have a way to get across the moat, and this is where the drawbridge comes from. Everyone knows what a drawbridge is, a bridge that can be lowered to allow access to the castle across the moat, or raised in the case of an attack. Although, it has to be said, some castles didn't even bother with a drawbridge, they just had a regular stone bridge, which of course still bottlenecked opposing attacking forces. And ultimately still something that was obviously, still very defensible in the case of an attack. Now, castles didn't just change in form. We're talking about stone buildings and whatever else. It wasn't just the form of castles that changed, but also their function as well. Don't forget, the castle was the home of a noble lord. And as a result, many castles were built not just to be defensible, but also to impress and intimidate and represent the lord's power. And further to this, they also had to be comfortable places to live. This was something that became more of a priority for many, especially wealthy lords as time went on. They wanted their donjons, they wanted their castles to be comfortable, right? Sometimes even at the cost of defensibility. In the 11th and into the 12th centuries, donjons were expanded and enlarged in many castles, often making them much weaker to attacks, so as to provide a more comfortable living space for the noble family that lived there. Now, you might have seen some pictures or even visited an old castle, or perhaps some ruins, and you may have seen the large, the almost cavernous interiors of some of the old donjons inside these castle complexes. For the most part, they weren't as big as they looked. They weren't actually that cavernous inside. They were usually partitioned with interior wooden walls that haven't stood the test of time. But nonetheless, donjons became more expansive, they became more lavishly decorated, they became more visually impressive, even if it meant that they became harder to defend. Again, the political needs of the lords that lived in them sometimes outweighed the military needs, and they needed to make sure their castle looked as grandiose and impressive as possible. But it has to be said, their defences also improved as time went on. This trade-off wasn't one that was easily made in many cases, and there were castles that became more and more defensible as time moves on. We move now into the 12th and 13th century. Castle construction continued to develop quite quickly as new technologies were adopted and incorporated into their design. In the late 12th century, a profound shift in how castles were built took place, one that began not even with construction, but it actually began with where they were constructed, the locations that were chosen. Prior to the late 12th century, most castles, very common to build them on a raised area, as we talked about, on a natural or an artificial hill, on a hill that had been enlarged with manual labor, with people digging ditches and transporting earth there. Or they were used. They would use existing fortifications from years past and then maybe, you know, improve upon or build upon them. This obviously very strongly dictated the shape that these castles could be, as the bailey would have to fit the terrain, right? It would have to be shaped around the topography of the hill that it was on top of, for example. But towards the 13th century, towards the beginning of the 13th century here, castles began instead to be built more uniformly in shape, using polygonal shapes that incorporated towers along the curtain walls. Instead of looking at the top of a hill and going, that's a great place for a castle, we'll just make it work. Instead, they looked for a place that would suit what they wanted the castle to look like, and instead of compromising the shape of the castle, they would make the castle into the shape that they wanted to incorporate the latest design, the latest breakthroughs, innovations in castle building technology. It might surprise you to learn this, right? But prior to the 13th century, towers weren't really common in castles. There'd be a gatehouse, sure, and there'd be the donjon as well, which I guess in some cases you could call it, you know, you could call a donjon a tower. But that'd be it. The walls wouldn't have towers along them. Now, however, castles are being built with regular, straight walls, and there would be towers interspersed along them, and especially at the corners. And what this would do, these towers that sort of protruded from the walls themselves, from the curtain walls, they would provide a firing platform for defenders that ran parallel to the wall. Towers that stick out of the wall a bit, that allow people from inside these towers to shoot at attackers from the side, not just from straight on, parallel to the wall. This is referred to as enfilading fire, right? It increased the defensive pressure on attackers enormously because now they're being attacked from people on the battlements on top of the walls and also from the side, people shooting at them now from these towers. Archers would fire through arrow slits. Of course, everyone's seen an arrow slit. These arrow slits are built into the castle walls themselves, narrow windows that found a balance between range of fire from the inside while also not exposing the archer inside to fire from the outside. But archers could also fire from the battlements. Battlements, you can imagine what the battlements of a castle looks like. These crenellated walls, that pattern of rectangular gaps, defining characteristic of the iconic castle, of course. The parapet of a castle, the wall on top of the battlement, would be divided into crenels, the gaps, and merlons, being the higher bit. You'd take cover behind a merlon, lean out behind through a crenel, you'd fire through the crenel, and then take cover through the merlon to avoid enemy fire. So these straight crenellated walls reinforced with protruding towers, right, meant that archers could rain down fire on attackers from all angles. Never mind a palisade wall, you know, that is nowhere near, it pales in comparison to the size and the shape and the grandeur and the defensibility of a stone wall. You've now got archers on top of that firing from every angle conceivable against these attackers that are attempting to storm the wall, which they didn't do very often, obviously, because they knew it was almost certainly going to be a death sentence, right? There are also a bunch of other architectural innovations that influenced castle design in this period. None of it was that exciting, to be honest. Things like barrel-pointed or groined vaults over undercrofts and cisterns with elaborate scarped drains. I mean, boring. We're not interested in that. But there were some other cool features of castles from this period. And one of them was the development of increasingly cunning postern gates. Now, you may know what a postern gate is, a secret hidden entrance to a castle designed to avoid the detection of an attacking and especially besieging enemy. And its function, the function of a postern gate, was to allow people to still come and go from the castle even while it was under attack, even while it was under siege. Postern gates enabled messengers and supplies to enter and leave the castle at will. But they were almost always very small, very well hidden, you know, tucked away out of the notice of any besieging armies. Sometimes, however, they would obviously result in the downfall of the defence of a castle. Sieges would be successful if the postern gate was opened perhaps by a traitor from within the castle, or if it were discovered and attacked at the wrong moment. So postern gates didn't come without risk, but most castles had one all the same, and they were a way, again, to help a castle that was being besieged hold out against a besieging army for a little longer than they otherwise would. Finally, as we well and truly move into the 13th century, another new concept emerged and largely took over castle design from here on out. Long gone, of course, is the shaping of castle to the terrain. It's all straight walls and towers now, as I mentioned. But in addition to this, castles began to be built with concentric defences. Rather than just a single curtain wall, from the early 13th century onwards, castles were instead built with several curtain walls, again, depending on size, often two. Each curtain wall would be set higher than the last. You have your outer one, then the inner one would be set a little higher. And this meant, right, that there was another set of obstacles for attackers to get through in order to seize the castle. But it didn't stop at just them having to storm two sets of walls. Because think about this. Imagine the enemy, they've stormed one of the walls, they've stormed the outer curtain wall, and they've taken it, right? They've managed to breach through the first wall, and they're now in this middle area between the outer wall and the inner wall, these concentric walls here. Both walls are lined with archers and other defenders. And while the attackers are bottlenecked in the area between these two walls, you've got people firing arrows, chucking stuff down from every angle while you're getting across to breach the second wall and get through to the donjon, the inner part of this castle. So it meant that you were effectively surrounded, taking fire from every angle and in a very difficult position, so much so that this area is basically, they were called killing fields as attacking armies attempted to make their way through these highly concentrated areas, these enclosed spaces, under continuous heavy fire from people on both walls. A very, very difficult thing indeed to take the inner part of a castle while going through a killing field like this. Concentric castles, as a result, became the standard design for European castles from the 13th century onwards, as their defensive effectiveness was absolutely unmatched. But what was behind all these innovations? Why was it that all of these new innovations, these new technologies, begin to spring up in European castle design at this time? It's still a matter of some debate. Not everyone's going to agree with this conclusion here. But the broad consensus seems to be that a lot of it was spurred on by the Crusades. As Christians travelled to and fought in the Holy Land, they came across architectural and technological innovation in many of the places they saw, not just in the Holy Land itself, but also on the way there. It's thought that exposure to Byzantine architecture also had a strong influence on the way that castle designers went on to build European castles. Fortifications out east had all sorts of characteristics that were unfamiliar to Europeans, not just the ones that were incorporated into European design as well. I mean, these European castle designers pilfered plenty of ideas from Eastern castles, but not all of them You know, they took concentric defences, towers for enfilade fire, sure, that sort of stuff. But eastern castles had things like arrow slits on multiple stories. European castle builders were convinced that this weakened castle walls. They didn't often put multiple stories of arrow slits into walls. And many castles built by Islamic forces had towers that weren't even connected to castles themselves. They had sort of almost little drawbridges that used planks that enabled defenders to go out to these exterior towers and have a greater range of fire on attackers there. And this was not something that was adopted by in European castle architecture, but it was very, very common in Islamic castle design. Other advancements as well, other pieces of technology like bent entrances, where gatehouses would have corridors that doubled back on themselves, like a queue at the airport. They were very common in the East, never really adopted in the West. It, you know, they could double the time it took for an attacker to get from the inside to the outside of a gatehouse, but never really caught on in Europe. But other advancements like machicolations, downward-facing holes built into battlements that allowed defenders to drop things onto attackers below, they were pilfered from Eastern castle design, and they became very commonplace in the West. But as we move from the 13th into the 14th centuries and beyond, the classical ideal of the medieval castle, multiple curtain walls, crenellated battlements, towers, sometimes a moat, big keep in the middle, this is when it really began to solidify. And it's probably what you picture in your mind when you think of a classical, a typical medieval castle. These castles were commonly found throughout France and England, two regions that led the way with castle design and construction, but that's not to say that they weren't common in other areas. Heaps of them were built in Iberia, of course, due to the ongoing conflict there between Christians and Muslims. And there are thousands, tens of thousands of other castles spread from Scotland to the Baltics, from Germany to Malta. They were everywhere. They were everywhere. But many of the famous castles that survived from the medieval period, many of the castles that were built, you know, throughout these years that we've already discussed today, they've survived, of course, built of stone, many of them. They have stood the test of time. They've become iconic buildings today. The Scottish Edinburgh Castle from the 11th century, the French Chateau Gaillard from the 12th, the Welsh Beaumaris Castle from the 13th century, the English Bodiam Castle from the 14th with its ornamental moat. All of these castles have stood the test of time and give you an insight. You can go online and compare the 14th century Bodiam Castle with its crenellations, with its straight walls and its protruding towers, to the 11th century Edinburgh Castle, built on top of a hill, its shape dictated by the terrain. Very interesting to see the way that these castles have evolved over time in line with what we've already talked about. But let's now turn our attention to how they were built. How and where as well, although we've already touched upon that a little bit. A fair few different factors went into selecting the location for a castle. It needed to be in, obviously, a readily defensible location. It needed to have ready access to nearby resources, particularly stone. That was the really important thing. But being near a major travel route was also something that was of great benefit to a castle because it helped to control the movement of people, not just, you know, military personnel, but also civilians and particularly merchants. It allowed lords to tax travelling traders who used the roads. Most castles were built near towns or indeed inside towns. But if they weren't, it was still quite common for towns to spring up around them, near them. Again, given the castle's role as an important political and economic centre, it wasn't uncommon for an isolated castle to, you know, over time become an urbanised centre as more and more people wanted to be close to the seat of power in the surrounding region. They were built in positions that often made them look impressive. This was a lesser priority for many castle builders, but they did want them to look as grand, as impressive as possible. And they're often built in ways that forced visitors, whether hostile or not, to take the scenic route in order to get to them, you know, with winding roads that sort of showed off the impressive defences or indeed the grandeur and the scale of these buildings here to anyone who was visiting, whether they were of hostile intent or not. And again, this was about impressing people, a sense of grandeur, a sense of importance and power. And, you know, sometimes, as I say, in the case of a castle like Bodiam Castle, the moat would just be ornamental rather than defensive, for instance. It just made the place look a bit nicer. Anyway, once you'd selected a location that was sufficiently defensible and sufficiently grand, with access to the resources that you'd need, you'd begin construction. Prior to stone castles becoming the norm, you'd just build with wood and earth, as I say, both of which easy to come by and work with. You dig it up, you chop it down. You didn't need skilled labourers to build an earthen or a wooden castle, just people who could chop wood and dig, rather than, you know, the experienced stonemasons that you'd need for a stone construction. Stone Very expensive, as I mentioned before. It was difficult to quarry. It was difficult to transport, given how heavy it was. It still is. I mean, stone is still heavy today. It's not like stone used to be heavier. But this was one of the major logistical hurdles that building a castle out of stone entailed. Often castles would be built near a quarry just to lessen the heavy expenses of transporting stone from one place to another. Often if there were a quarry nearby, that would increase the suitability of a location for a castle to be built. Because again, as I say, loading stone onto wagons or onto barges and onto a river, a very, very expensive and time-consuming thing to do. And then once it arrived at the location where you're building, it had to be worked. Stonemasons were not cheap, and skilled ones particularly were very expensive indeed. The whole process of building a stone castle was time-consuming. I mean, a simple Mott and Bailey castle with a wooden palisade and earthworks and maybe a stone donjon in the middle would take weeks, maybe months. A stone castle on the other side, big expansive thing made of stone, it could take years and years, up to a decade to build a stone castle. So you can see some of the stuff that went into it. They were built using technology such as the treadwheel crane. These are cranes, you may have seen them. They've basically got giant hamster wheels that propel them, that work them. These are operated by people walking inside the hamster wheel to operate these treadwheel cranes. And of course, they'd use wooden scaffolding that was adapted and improved to bear the weight of enormous quantities of stone. But they were just outrageously expensive. Stone castles, so, so expensive to build. Here's what James of St. George, one of the most famous and skilled castle builders of the Middle Ages, here's what he had to say about the costs involved with building a castle. In case you should wonder where so much money could go in a week, we would have you know that we have needed, and shall continue to need, 400 masons, both cutters and layers, together with 2,000 less skilled workmen, 100 carts, 60 wagons, and 30 boats bringing stones and sea coal, 200 quarrymen, 30 smiths, and carpenters for putting in the joists and floorboards and other necessary jobs. All of this takes no account of the garrison, nor of purchases of material, of which there will have to be a great quantity. The men's pay has been and still is very much in arrears, and we are having the greatest difficulty in keeping them because they have simply nothing to live on. Castles were a ridiculously costly endeavor to build, and it makes a lot of sense. You can see why only powerful noble families were able to build them. But here's the thing. Even after they were completed, even after they were built, the costs didn't dry up. They had to be maintained, and this wasn't cheap either. They required constant repair and upkeep to remain defensible and habitable. So you can understand. It's very, very obvious why only very wealthy noble families had castles to call their own. But of course, maintenance wasn't the biggest concern of some castle holders. The biggest concern for many people living in castles was an attack from an enemy. As you might have already gathered, attacking a castle, it wasn't an easy thing to do, not at all. But nonetheless, castles were routinely attacked and besieged throughout the bulk of the Middle Ages. They were designed to be as impregnable as possible, of course. And often they were extremely difficult to assault effectively, but people did it, typically through the use of siege warfare. Attacking a castle was possible. It was difficult, it was costly, and it was likely to fail. It was better instead to surround the castle, besiege it, and prevent food and supplies from getting to the people inside. The supplies that the people inside had on hand would only last so long, of course, and if you were able to wait long enough and make sure that no new supplies got to the people inside, eventually famine and disease would overtake those that were besieged inside the castle, and they would be forced to surrender or unable to defend themselves from your attack when it finally came due to being, you know, weakened with hunger. But it could take a long time to starve a castle out, however, months, sometimes years, in which time the defenders could call in reinforcements, or you, as the attacking army, could have supply issues yourself and lose momentum from your aggressive campaign. But if you needed to assault a castle, you had to make proper preparations. If you were going to launch a full-scale attack on a castle, it was no good relying on overwhelming numbers of force of arms. This was not going to do it. For instance, in 1403, Caernarfon Castle in Wales, it held out against two separate attacks from besieging armies with fewer than 40 garrisoned archers. Reports tell of 37 people holding an entire castle by themselves in the face of enormous armies on the outside. So you couldn't take a castle by sheer force of numbers. That wasn't going to do it. Instead, you had to rely on siege weapons, siege engines, mangonels, ballistae. These could attack and weaken fortifications or indeed kill the defenders garrisoning the castle inside it with their enormous heavy projectiles. But these weapons, they were not as effective as you might think. They're often subject to counterattacks from the defending forces due to their somewhat limited range. You could also use siege towers, great big towers that would be rolled towards the castle on wheels, meaning you didn't have to scale the walls. You just climbed the siege tower once it reached the curtain wall and stepped onto the battlements off a plank, essentially, to fight there at the top of the wall. These aren't new. I mean, siege towers have been used since antiquity, but they're often deployed in conjunction with battering rams in taking medieval castles, unless, of course, there was a moat or these ditches in the way. That's one of the reasons that the fortifications like that were so important, as they kept away siege towers, they kept away battering rams. You could also, of course, as we talked about before, send sappers to dig tunnels underneath the walls. Difficult to do if there was a moat or if the walls' fortifications were dug sufficiently deep, as we talked about. But the most famous and the most effective medieval weapon used against the defences of a castle was, of course, the trebuchet. A trebuchet is an enormous catapult. It uses a sling on the end of a long arm to hurl heavy projectiles enormous distances. Unlike smaller catapults like mangonels, the sheer range of trebuchets kept them safe from the range of a castle's defences. Often a castle's defensive capabilities ranged out to 300-400 meters, and trebuchets were able to fire projectiles up to 450 meters. The classic trebuchet, of course, the counterweight trebuchet, used a heavy weight, thousands and thousands of kilograms, up to 4,000-5,000 kilograms. This would be used to swing the arm around at a great speed and fire a projectile, as I say, you know, almost half a kilometer in distance. These projectiles were usually between 12 and 15 kilograms, although there were some that weighed hundreds of kilograms that could only be propelled a shorter distance. Trebuchets were enormously effective, the most powerful siege weapon of the medieval era, of course. But they weren't without their drawbacks. Even the mighty trebuchet they were difficult and time-consuming to build. They weren't easily moved around. Some siege engineers preferred smaller siege weapons that could be deployed at a shorter range in greater numbers in order to overwhelm the defending forces. But nonetheless, the trebuchet, for a long time, since its inception all the way through to the development of a new technology that rendered the trebuchet obsolete, the trebuchet was, of course, the dominant and perhaps most powerful piece of siege warfare hardware that was available to medieval armies during this period. But even the trebuchet would be rendered obsolete, as I say, as the next great technological advancement developed further and further, obsoleting not just trebuchets, but also the very castles that they sought to bring low as well. I'm referring, of course, to gunpowder. This is not going to be a surprise to anyone. You can hear all about gunpowder in episode 115. It was naturally a complete game changer when it came to not just castles and siege warfare, but warfare in general. To begin with, castles could withstand early gunpowder weapons, and some were even built with cannons in mind. They were, you know, seeking to remain defensible in the face of such a weapon. Towers were built to be round so as to deflect cannon shots, and walls were built thicker and thicker. But as gunpowder weapons improved and became more powerful, castles became less and less reliable as defensible military buildings. Many castles went so far as to adopt cannons into their defences themselves. They'd build gun ports into the sides of castle, of the walls and towers. But the offensive power of gunpowder weapons was too great for the defensive capability of castles. Walls, no matter how thick, would crumble under sustained assault from gunpowder weapons, and even the changes that castle builders made to compensate for this, they weren't enough. Slowly but sure. Well, I'm not even sure about how slowly, to be honest. Castles began to be phased out in favour of a brand new design that came out of Italy, the Star Fort. You might have seen Star Forts. They're those low-lying, often pentagonal fortresses with angled walls and very sharp corners designed to minimise incoming cannon fire while maximising the fire range of the defensive cannons that would be emplaced on these bastions. I talk a lot more about Star Forts in episode 115. You can listen to that for more details there. But here's another reason that star forts aren't castles, quite aside from their design and appearance here. You know, star forts are a different branch of military technology and don't really come under the history of the castle in the same way, because they are not castles, because they were almost always a pure military building. We discussed before that a castle was usually home to a noble family. There, of course, were some castles that were home to military orders, particularly throughout the period, where we saw the Crusades and that sort of thing. But for the most part, castles were built to be occupied by noble families, and star forts were not. Noble families, as the advent of gunpowder changed the way that warfare was wrought, noble families, they instead began to take up residence in grand manor houses in the country, impressive and stately and expensive, but utterly indefensible, of course. Times changed. The ruling classes no longer needed to ensconce themselves in fortified buildings. Instead, they were free to, shoot swans or whatever it is rich people do. I've got no idea. But funnily enough, after a time, things actually came back to not quite where they began, but history did, the circle of history turned. And in the centuries that followed, during times like, the Romance period, when Gothic Revival architecture took hold, all of a sudden, rich people were building castles again. They were back in vogue, not as military structures this time, not to be defended, but instead, as interest in medieval architecture arose and these grand sweeping romantic visions of the past influenced the way that architecture, art and culture continued to develop. The famous Neuschwanstein Castle, built by Ludwig II of Bavaria, we've talked about that in episode 136, get across it. This is an example of one such castle, quote-unquote, built for its appearance rather than, to defend a couple of lakes in the German Alps. And the reason the word castle isn't super appropriate when talking about Neuschwanstein is technically we should call a structure like that a palace, not a castle. It's a palace because it was built as a grandiose residence designed for the use of royals or, other high-ranking nobs. There are palaces all throughout the world, but not for military defense. A big building designed to be defended is a fortress. A huge fancy house for rich nobles to live in is a palace. If you combine the two, then, and only then, do you have a castle. And castles were an enormous part of the history of medieval Europe. They acted as political, military, economic, and administrative power centers, as I mentioned. They changed and developed over time in response to new technologies and innovations in architecture and warfare. And they remained a centerpiece of European medieval life. Today, castles have become a romantic ideal, mostly, and it's entertaining to see how utterly indefensible many famous castles from popular media would actually be in real life. But all the same, castles have remained an enduring symbol of the Middle Ages, and they provide a very interesting insight into the life and the times of the people that lived during this period of history. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. That is the history of the castle, a whirlwind tour, a brief history of a very important piece of military and I guess political hardware from the medieval era. And it's interesting to see, the distinction between the reality of the history of the castle and sort of how we perceive them in our minds in popular media today, because they are a very enduring symbol of history. And it is interesting to sort of pick apart what has lasted in terms of historical realism and our conception of castles and what hasn't. You look at many fantastical interpretations of what a castle is, and it would just be the easiest thing in the world to overrun them because they're built on the side of a mountain, for example, and you just climb the mountain and attack them from above or whatever. It's quite interesting to see how this sort of has evolved from historical realism into, our conception of it today. Anyway, that is that. I do hope you enjoyed the episode. Thanks so much for listening. We're going to close, of course, the episode with all the normal boring housekeeping stuff. Halfasshistory.net is the website. If you want to go to anchor.fm/halfasshistory, you'll find the feed you can subscribe to. And I want to thank, of course, all the people who are getting in touch every week. There's a contact form on the website if you want to send in a topic suggestion or anything else like that. Always good to hear from people, get their feedback. But the biggest and most special thank you, of course, goes to the people supporting me on Patreon. And there are a number of new people who have jumped on the Patreon bandwagon. Thank you so much to all the people who have just jumped on board. It's great to have you along. If you'd like to join their exalted ranks, patreon.com/halfassedhistory. You can go there, get early, get access to early episodes, bonus content, all sorts of stuff there like that. I say it every week. You can do it if you want. You don't have to. Anyway, that is that for another week of Half-Assed History. See you back here next week for more nonsense. Until then, leaving you with a question posed on Reddit. Reddit historian Ben Marvin wants to know, if castles were built to protect from attackers, how do they ever get built if people were getting attacked all the time?